So I've got here a bag of frozen dead rats. To be perfectly honest, I do have a separate deep freeze for my rats. Right now, I'm just on a very intensive project that is requiring a whole lot of them, and there was a bit of an overflow, so I've got a few up here in my regular freezer.
Oh, yeah, you heard that correctly. Peeling the pelt off a semi-frozen rat is not usually part of the job description for producers here at The Current, but that is what our Karen Marley set off to do when she visited taxidermist Ankitsa Risk in Hamilton, Ontario.
So let's get our little friend here. And I've got my scalpel here, and I'm just going to start with this guy because he is going to be fully clothed in an anthropomorphic style mount. I'm going to go in through his back, and then we're going to start to peel off his skin.
Can I help with the peeling off?
Yeah, you certainly can.
It's tricky. Oh, no.
I'm actually going to get right in around his back leg. So you can see his ankle is still within the pelt there, and we've just, it's like he's caught in his skinny jeans and can't quite get them off. You're just gonna snip through the ankle here, being very careful not to snip the pelt. There you go. Really, in specimens this small, you want to be careful. It takes the most detail in the heads, because if you accidentally chop off an ear or chop off an eyelid, you sort of have to mask that by, say, putting an eye patch or a hat or, you know, giving him glasses. Now we've got this lovely rat pelt to work with, and he's ready to be stuffed.
Ankitsa Risk and her business partner Jessica Lee turn dead creatures into unusual art, sometimes with Jessica's kids looking on. They are part of a taxidermy revival, teaching rat stuffing workshops to everyone from middle-aged women to corporate team building events, even couples out on date nights.
So what do we have here?
So here we have a three-headed Cerber rat strapped down and chained to a crystal cave. I focus on like whimsical dioramas and portraitures. I grew up like on a dirt road in the country and was always surrounded by animals. And as a young girl, you know, they were my friends. I like sort of thought of them as like, wouldn't it be great if they were just always around and doing these human things?
It's just that sort of day and age where, like, the unique is held high. It's okay to be, you know, a taxidermist mom.
What do you think of the animals?
I like them.
Yeah. Which one's your favorite?
Ooh, that's hard. The spring one?
The farmer?
Yeah.
There's a rat farmer in your house?
Yeah.
Cool.
It was like a nice warm hug to see how many people were interested in taking the classes and treating it as an art form and not an obscurity.
And now there's a community.
And now there's a little community, and it's so cool.
A quickly growing community.
And they're loving.
They're like animal lovers.
Well, we are going to post pictures on our website today of Ankitsa Risk and Jessica Lee's art, cbc.ca/thecurrent. They're just two of the many people participating in what is known today as rogue taxidermy. It is a world inhabited largely by women. And for these rogue taxidermists, the ethics of how the animals are treated are front and center concerns.
I get all of my rat specimens from a local reptile zoo, and then we actually donate all of the meat back to the zoo to feed the crocodiles and the alligators there. We're working with animals that were part of the food chain that maybe never got to see a life past that food chain. We're giving them a new life, and
these animals aren't, like, not like you're working with a roadkill or whatever that just died by accident.
We do that as well. We are, I guess, part of vulture culture, where if we do find specimens that are still fully intact and workable, we're not opposed to picking them up.
No. Not at all. Yeah, give it a wee shake off the bugs, and there you go. Yeah.
It's about preservation and really honoring a deceased animal versus, you know, I'm going to kill you for your pelt.
I would never revel or glorify in the death of a beautiful animal.
Well, the rogue taxidermy community has grown around the world. Serena Brewer is an artist who co-founded the movement in 2004. She is in Minneapolis, Minnesota. Hello.
Hey, Anna Maria.
What is rogue taxidermy, Serena?
Well, rogue taxidermy actually encompasses a lot of different things. A large part of it is what you're talking about right now and the people that are going to the classes and learning the actual craft of taxidermy. And the other end of it are people creating artwork that's in galleries and art museums. The definition that we put forth in 2004 when we first formed the Minnesota Association of Rogue Taxidermists, which for the record was actually a collective of artists. We were not a group of taxidermists. We define rogue taxidermy as a genre of pop surrealist art characterized by mixed media sculptures containing conventional taxidermy related materials that are used in an unconventional manner. So rogue taxidermy can be made out of animal bones. It can be made out of mummified animal components. It can be actually taxidermy, like the hide of the animal.
What does your taxidermy art look like?
A lot of it is using the hide of an animal to create kind of hybrid animals that are inspired by mythology. Another strain of my work where I actually take the body of an animal and I mummify it and I cover it in gold leaf.
Do you have a favorite of your own work?
I do have a few favorites. I do have one called Mother's Little Helper Monkey, which is a winged monkey holding a martini that's wearing a fez. Most recently, there was one titled Noircissist, which was a combination of a neighbor had donated to me one of their hens that had passed on, their urban chicken ranchers, and that was a stillborn baby goat, kind of an upright position with a feather kind of antenna on the head.
Why did you start working in taxidermy?
Well, it was kind of an evolution, actually. When I grew up, there were a lot of pets in our family. Daily life revolved around this menagerie of animals, and I was very attached to all of them. I spent a lot of time outdoors interacting with nature. So when an animal would die, I was really heartbroken. So everything got a very lavish funeral, a pet or a dead bird that I would find outside in the yard. My parents were both artists and attended the Minneapolis College of Art and Design. So I also attended MCAD, and when I was working at MCAD, I just began working with animal remains and bones because I had been collecting natural history artifacts like that my entire life. And using animal bones and then mummified animals that I was putting gold leaf on eventually necessitated learning a better way to make them last longer. So I started just kind of teaching myself taxidermy from a couple of books and some VHS tapes.
And how did people react when you first started doing taxidermy art?
There's a huge amount of pushback back in the early 1990s. My work was seen as being created for shock value. People said it was disrespectful. In that day, using an animal's remains, that just was not an artistic medium. So therefore, anything that you created out of that was absolutely not art. So a lot has changed since then. I used to receive tons of hate mail almost on a daily basis. But now I've been hate mail free for at least 5 years, so that's good. Instead, now I receive emails from other artists who are absolutely thrilled to have found me because they work with similar materials.
So when you were getting all that pushback and the hate mail, you're an artist, did you ever think that you should do something else? I mean, how did you react on a really personal level to that kind of criticism?
Well, I think if you're basing what you're creating on what other people are thinking about it, then you're not really being true to yourself, and that's really not what art is about. You know, when you're using an animal remains, it's a lot different than using clay. Obviously, this is something that used to be a living thing. So when you were touching that and holding that, it's a really different experience. So like often when I'm creating work, like the sculpture that comes out of that sometimes even tells a story of where that animal came from and the history of that animal.
So you wouldn't be swayed by the criticism?
No, I would be here right now if I was. It was a hard road to get here. But now that the path has kind of been carved, you know, a lot of people are excited to follow that path and explore this kind of new horizon.
We asked PETA, People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals, what they think of rogue taxidermy. And here's what they had to say. I've got a clip here of Katie Arth, Media Assistant Manager for PETA.
The most important thing is to look at how the animal died. If the animal died naturally or in an accident, then PETA doesn't have a problem with preserving their carcass. The issue comes to what most animals who end up being taxidermied who are violently killed by hunters. No animal wants to be shot to death and have their heads mounted on a living room wall.
Serena Brewer, are you surprised that they're okay with the kind of art that you do?
This is really, really kind of very shocking for me to hear that. One thing that I do want to address that she said, an animal does not want to have its head mounted on the wall. And I think that part of the big problem with the rogue taxidermy art movement in the beginning of my work in the beginning was other people deciding for that animal how that animal wanted to be treated after it was dead. Like, I would get, you know, hate mail from people saying, you need to bury that squirrel. My response would be like, well, did you have a meeting with the squirrel before it passed on? And are you in charge of its last will and testament? How you deal with a dead person or a dead animal, you can't really impose your personal opinion about how, you know, that should be dealt with. But yeah, I guess I'm surprised to hear that they've kind of come around on that. The Minnesota Association of Rogue Taxidermists, how we reframed taxidermy really has kind of changed how everybody looks at taxidermy now, including animal rights people.
Mm-hmm, because they had originally said they'd called it cruel. They said you can never know where the bodies came from. They really have become more accepting. Huh?
Yes, definitely.
I want to play you another clip. This is from Beth Beverly in Philadelphia, who specializes in alternative and wearable taxidermy. She works with animals that have died naturally or have been killed at humanely run farms, but she does work with hunters under specific conditions. Listen to her.
I do not condone hunting and killing animals simply to make something out of their hides. If you are going to take an active part in harvesting an animal, it's a huge insult to not use every part of it. I've got a variety of clients that I work with, and some of them will, you know, bring me a part of a bear, and then I'll knock down the price a bit if they share some of the bear meat with me. I've had guys bring me snakes. They actually didn't want the meat, so I got to keep the snake meat for myself. I did have a client who hunted a coyote. So I actually made a coyote stew. I've eaten skunk. If they don't want it, I'll eat it. I'll feed it to my cat. I also feel like if I'm consuming this meat that's readily available to me, that's one less person taking part in the factory farming industrial complex.
Serena Brewer, what do you think of that?
She's spot on with all of that. Beth is actually one of the members of the Minnesota Association of Rogue Taxidermists. You could not be part of the group unless you pledged that you were only going to use animals that were ethically sourced. And she's taking that message out to everybody. It's waste not, want not. And if you're doing anything otherwise, you're being disrespectful to Mother Nature. What she's doing, she's really, it's like a higher level, more intimate relationship with the animal. When you're holding an animal and looking at it, I mean, you can't help but think about where it came from in the life that it had.
What's your own ethical code around the animals with which you work?
Well, I've never killed anything for my work. So all of my animals are either donated to me. Donated animals sometimes are nuisance animals that had to be destroyed. Squirrels, for example, that are destroyed by property owners. I do pick up roadkill, and I also use livestock remnants.
So what does taxidermy mean to you?
Taxidermy, what I do, my work, is an homage to the animal. It's really to commemorate the animal and tell the animal's story or my story through using that animal's body. I kind of distance myself from traditional taxidermists and especially the hunting culture and those types of mounts, because that's not where my work comes from. My work is about commemorating the animal's life, not about the experience of killing the animal, which is what trophy hunting is about and trophy mounts are about.
What would be your ultimate animal or collection of animals to taxidermy?
It's really an honor when people donate their pets to me. I've had several pets donated to me over the years. And when somebody gives me their pet, that means they really understand where I come from, where this art movement is coming from, and that's extremely meaningful.
Okay. Well, thanks for speaking with me today and explaining your art.
Well, thank you for having me, Anna Maria.
Serena Brewer, one of the founders of Rogue Taxidermy, the movement. She joined us from Minneapolis, Minnesota. Well, for inspiration, many rogue taxidermists look to Victorian artists who also created a tableau featuring rats, cats, and more. Joanna Ebenstein is the co-author of Walter Potter's Curious World of Taxidermy, about a quirky Victorian amateur taxidermist. She was involved in bringing taxidermy workshops to Brooklyn, New York about 8 years ago. She's also the co-founder of Brooklyn's Morbid Anatomy Museum, which has now closed. Joanna Ebenstein has looked at what cultural objects can tell us about our changing attitudes towards death, and she joins us now from New York. Hello.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
Well, it's good to have you with us. I've got lots of questions. First of all, why were the people interested in learning taxidermy through the workshops you helped organize? What were they there to learn?
You know, I can tell you that when we started the class, it was just an idea. A friend of mine, she had taught herself this art. And when she told me that she was doing this sort of work, I said, oh, that's incredible. Why don't you come teach a class about it here? In my mind, I thought, okay, if I'm interested in this, there's at least 20 other people that are interested. Well, it'll be a successful class and we'll do fine. Little did I know it was a phenomenon. Our wait list at one point was 650 people. The thing that I would say mostly stood out to me is the female aspect of it. Seeing a man there was rare. There's a crafty element. There's an element of the love of miniatures and dollhouses and making something quirky and unique. But I believe that a lot of people were there to look at death in some way, to kind of challenge themselves, to open up an animal and fathom their own feelings about what that meant. I think it was a way to face something that they were curious and maybe slightly afraid about.
And how does rogue taxidermy relate to the art of Walter Potter, the Victorian artist?
Well, I think if there is a forefather of rogue taxidermy, it is Walter Potter. He was a Victorian taxidermist who really popularized this idea of stuffing animals and posing them into human-like situations. So what he's most famous for are these really large-scale tableaus with dozens, if not more, animals. Things like the kitten's wedding. It transcends kitsch somehow. He has, I would say Walter Potter, if he lived today, he'd probably be doing model train sets or something. But at the time that he was born, taxidermy was just a part of culture. It wasn't seen as perverse or grotesque.
And I should just tell our listeners, we will link to some of the pictures of things like the kitten's wedding and what's the schoolhouse one? The bunny
schoolhouse? The rabbit schoolhouse.
Rabbit schoolhouse, yeah.
Yeah, incredible. It's one of the best. You'll see it. And there's something in this work that today, because of our attitudes about animal rights and our attitudes about the appropriate ways to view dead bodies, there is a perverse element that has a tension with the absolute adorableness of it.
So it really does speak to differences to how we see animals in death then and now.
In my opinion, 100%. Through the whole Morbid Anatomy project, that was always my intent, was to show objects from the past that exhibited such a different attitude towards looking at death that it would force us to question our own attitudes as being specific to our own time and place. I've never seen another culture like ours where it is seen as inappropriate to look at death. You know, my whole life I've been interested in taxidermy and I've been interested in images of death. And my whole life people were telling me I was morbid and horrible. And I used to think, okay, maybe I'm a morbid, horrible person. But then at a certain point, I began to just think about it and say, well, okay, I'm looking at the past, and every single other time period or culture that I can see had an above-board, dignified discourse and art practice around death. And when you think about it, death is the great human mystery, really. It will happen to each of us. We don't know definitively what it is or why it happens. How could we not be interested in death? The idea that people could not be curious about death, to me, seems morbid.
And so in line with that, what other historical objects related to death do you collect?
Right now, I'm really interested in objects from Latin American culture. This is a contemporary phenomenon. It's called Santa Muerta. And this is literally saint or holy death. It's a depiction of something that looks like the Grim Reaper, but in a female form. And this figure is paid homage to and prayed to, and offerings are made to her so that she will help people on earth. I feel like we're seeing a return of these older ideas of death, these kind of memento mori or dance of death figures in which death is personified as a godlike figure and with a capriciousness of a godlike figure, this kind of unpredictability of when death will come.
Mm. You also collect antique wax anatomical figures, do you know that?
I collect photos of antique wax anatomical figures. I can't really afford to buy them. Part of why they're so expensive is they're quite rare. You know, they were made most of them between the 18th and 19th centuries, early 20th century a bit. So to me, my favorite of all the anatomical wax models is this thing. My other book that I worked on was called The Anatomical Venus. And that's what they called this figure that they made in 18th century Florence. So made around 1780, life-sized beautiful. It's like a painting of a Venus come to life, only it's three-dimensional, and it's colored wax with real human hair, Venetian glass eyes, and in a rosewood and Venetian glass case. And it was made to teach the general public at the first public science museum in Florence, Italy, about human anatomy. You can lift off her breastplate and dissect her. And eventually, after you peel off all eight layers, you find a fetus in her womb. They're just incredibly powerful figures. And kind of like Walter Potter's taxidermy, they exist on this edge, this tension between categories that we don't think fit together. She's incredibly beautiful and deeply disturbing at the same time. And so it's kind of this flickering that happens on the edge. And these are the kind of objects that I'm drawn to and what they tell us by challenging our very notions of these opposites and these dualities.
Am I right in understanding that some of these then were created at a time when people were learning more about anatomy and medicine, and there was a fascination with things that really hadn't been looked at before?
Absolutely. That's a really important point. You know, this is after the Renaissance, when we have, you know, Da Vinci dissecting corpses and things like this, and we have Vesalius kind of redefining how we're looking at the body. And until around 1543, when Vesalius published his groundbreaking book about human anatomy, people's beliefs about anatomy were stretching back to classical models that were basically incorrect because they were based on dissections that weren't made from humans mostly. They were mostly made from pigs and apes. And then by the time you get to the 18th century, anatomy is seen as like something gentlemen would be interested in. It's enlightened, it's forward thinking, it's progressive. Another part that's really important, and I think this deals with a lot of stuff that we see about death from the past, is religion. And I think that's the hardest thing for us to understand today. That in the 18th century, the human body was not just a material object. It was the mind of God made visible. It was God's finest creation. So there is this very real way in which to teach people to understand your own body was a religious act, a metaphysical act as well.
So interesting. And then, of course, if we fast forward to today, I was surfing around looking at different images of taxidermy and came across Iris Shefferstein, who designed shoes from the hooves of horses.
Interesting.
And sandals with taxidermy doves on them. Very, very unusual. A little unsettling, I have to admit. But it's really interesting that how art has really taken a place with this now.
Yeah. And I kind of think it's a long time coming. I think there's something generational about it as well. Like when I was growing up, I loved animals. I wanted to be a veterinarian or maybe a wildlife photographer. I love my pets. And at the same time, without any internal contradiction to myself, when animals died, my dad, God bless my father, very indulgent man, he bought formaldehyde for me. And he would put animals in jars, and I had a collection of them in my room. And to me, this was just an extension of my love of animals. I would never, ever kill an animal. And I loved animals, but I also loved them dead. Again, it's going back to these ideas of what is appropriate to do with a dead body. Is there something intrinsically disrespectful in keeping the body of something? And like Serena, I do not think there is. I think that in a culture in which it is seen as impolite to remind ourselves that death exists, that becomes this kind of response that is the most socially acceptable of them. But I was never like that. And I think a lot of women, more than men, have felt the same way, that there's always been a curiosity and a fascination and a lack of squeamishness about it. You know, something I've been thinking about a lot lately about feminine versus masculine, or men versus women, let's say, is that women are less squeamish about the body. And I think we kind of have no choice. You know, we menstruate, we have babies. Our body is like a force that changes things in very concrete ways, in a way that I don't think men deal with in as regular a way.
It's fascinating to listen to your thoughts on all of this. Thanks for sharing your ideas.
My pleasure.
Joanna Ebenstein, she's the co-author of Walter Potter's Curious World of Taxidermy. She co-founded Brooklyn's now defunct Morbid Anatomy Museum, and she joined us from New York. Something else we're going to have up on our website today, pictures of our guests' taxidermy art, including a music video for the Canadian punk rock band Billy Talent, which features Ann Kitsa Risk's rats and mice in stop motion action. Don't miss that. That will be on our website, cbc.ca/thecurrent. Coming up in our next half hour, how the deadliest terror attack in Somalia's history may be a unifying factor in a fractured population. How to channel that energy into the fight against Al-Shabaab. We'll be talking about that in our next half hour. I'm Anna Maria Tremonti. This is The Current.